Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson. Thank you for joining us today. Today we look at how aviation and aerospace items get converted to art and furniture. And I'm delighted to welcome Stuart Abbott to Extended. Stuart, welcome to Extended.
Hello there, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Now, I've followed you for, 10, 12 years it's got to have been. So you've probably got to have been my longest guest to track down and actually get on the podcast. But I'm fascinated by the work that you do. But before we talk about that, let's just go back and see, how did you get into aviation and the whole sector? And then how did that transpire into the engineering role you're doing?
Well, it goes way, way, way back. And I got my first car when I was 12. So I've always been someone who's... And so I've always been an engineering kind of mindset. I had an old Mini that I was doing up, and I had all these pipe dreams of making it into like a racing car or a rally car and stuff like that. And it never happened. I usually ended up scrapping them. And that carried on into when I was 16 and a half, and I joined the RAF as an aircraft engineer. Didn't do very well at school, and it was an option that I managed to sort of grab hold of. And yeah, I had a 10 and a half year career with the RAF.
Why did you go into the RAF, Stuart? Was it a choice, or was there a particular reason why we chose the RAF over the other services?
Don't know. It was because I'd always been involved with cars when I was young. I think it was just a case of moving on to planes, which sounds bonkers, but sort of mechanicking with garages and stuff wasn't something that I wanted to do. So I kind of thought, well, if I'm playing around with my cars, I'll just start messing around with someone else's planes, I suppose.
10 years with the RAF. Tell us a little bit about, your training, how you got inducted, sort of places you served, that sort of thing. Aircraft you worked on.
Yeah, it was... It was a difficult time, not going to lie, because I was so young. Like I said, I was 16 and a half, and then having to move out and join the RAF when most of my friends and stuff were going to college and looking at universities and things like that and having a whale of a time. I remember on just after my 18th birthday, I was in Saudi Arabia in the middle of the desert pulling trolleys in the Second Gulf War, which sounds brilliant, but at the time, it was quite nervy, and it was around the sort of 2001 area with 9/11 and the attacks in America and stuff like that. So there was heightened security everywhere. And my first posting after training, which I struggled with because I'm not very academically minded, I struggled with the training. However, I got posted to 5 Squadron at Coningsby on the Tornadoes, and it was one of the QRA squadrons. So to say I was at the front line of the RAF, you don't get much more front line than the QRA squadrons and reacting to terrorist threats and airliners and stuff like that.
Was that exciting, working in effect on a fast jet? Was that an exhilarating part of the job? I mean, to be an engineer and to be a mechanic and then work on fast jets, was that a fortunate deployment? Were you lucky, or was that a choice that you made?
There was some good deployments because it wasn't just to like bad areas. We had some good times. There was like deployments to America and places like that. And you have the good times, but then there's always the other end of the sword, which was the bad times. And when you're stuck in the desert for 3 months at a time. And the thing I found, because I was so young, I found it difficult because I didn't know an alternative. So I was working with engineers who were 10, 20, 30 years senior to me, who have been around and know it all, and they had a lot more kind of maturity. And there I am as a youngster thrust into this world of fast jets and everything going on with the world at the time. And it was you didn't really get much chance to think about it because there was always something happening. And the world was quite not a very nice place at the time, if that makes sense, because everything was about terrorism and stuff. And then you had Afghanistan coming up, and Yeah, it was difficult.
And what sort of work were you doing? What parts of the aircraft were you working on? What was your skill set?
So I was an airframe engineer. So I was primarily with hydraulics, pneumatics, structure, windscreens, everything like that. I was on the line as well. So I was the one who was dispatching the aircraft, doing the servicings and things like that. And then went back to RAF Cosford to do further trade training. And then went to another frontline tornado squadron after that. So I spent pretty much all my career on tornado F3s.
Wow.
I ended up
at
Leeming in North Yorkshire, which was where I kind of eventually got the idea of making things.
So did you come to the end of your service, or did you think of this before you left your service? How did Stuart Aviation Furniture come about then?
Well, I had a 100% closure record in my RAF career. So every single place I went ended up closing, because at the time the government were trying to save money and the forces were scaling down. So I just had enough, because everywhere I was posted to, it'd be all right, and then that would close. You would then end up going somewhere new, and you're always a new kid, so you ended up having to do all the parades, all the guard duty, go on all these, doing all these rubbish things, and it just got enough. So I left the RAF and decided to go into civil aviation. And it sounds really mad, but a friend of mine, who's not with us anymore, a friend of mine, Stu Kemp, he kind of rang me one day and says, I might be able to get you a job down at Monarch at Luton as a contractor.
Okay,
So I went down there and ended up working on the night shift there. And him and a couple of other guys taught me all about the structures work and the sort of how an aircraft is built. And I became one of their structural engineers, as well as doing all the other stuff with a passenger plane. But I was a specialist in structures. And I bloody loved it. And then...
what sort of aircraft was it, Stuart? Sorry to interrupt you.
I was working on... Well, Monarch at the time used to do third-party maintenance, so they would fix other people's planes as well. So I would be doing 757s, A320s, A321s, and then they'd also get in other airlines as well. So I was doing 767s and Airbus A300s. At the time, going from Tornadoes, which were designed not for maintenance, going up to massive planes, to me, these were like giants.
Yeah.
And it was a big kind of change to what I was used to.
And Stuart, you mentioned earlier that you weren't very academic, I think the term was that you used. The sort of things you're describing to me sound like lots of books, lots of studying, lots of understanding, lots of technical things. I suppose the question is, how did you make that transition from not being studious to becoming an expert in aircraft structures?
Hard work.
Yeah.
And trying to problem solve. I'm a very good problem solver, which give me a maths exam, I will quite happily fail that. And quite easily fail that without even trying, scratching my head, thinking, well, what's all this? I don't know all this. However, you give me a problem and I'll solve it. So I kind of muddled my way through all that. And I did the RAF career the hard way because of that. There was two routes you could go, whether you had GCSEs at certain grades for certain subjects, was you would be guaranteed further training. If not, then you had to work for it. But it was purely hard graft. And I've always worked hard to try and get to a goal. And that was how I did it. And I've always done that, and I always do now.
I normally say these sorts of questions for the end, but while it's in my head, I might as well ask it. I mean, in this world where everything is down to what exams have you got, what grades have you got, what badges do you hold? What accreditations do you hold? What sort of advice do you give to people coming into the aviation sector? Because you're still an airline engineer for an international airline in your spare time, I'd say.
Yeah.
What advice would you give them? Because I've tried to help some people come into the sector and they found it extremely daunting because of the first set of gatekeepers say, what exams have you got? What accreditations you've got? And these may be really, really hardworking individuals, but they just get banged out straight away.
It's you've got to be yourself. And with anyone in aviation, you can't bluff your way through. Not these days, because it's such a small industry now. And I've worked, even in the last few years, I've worked with people who have come out of university and have got all these qualifications, master's degrees and stuff like that. But you put a spanner in their hands or you put something sort of practical in them and they struggle. And it doesn't matter if you're young, old, if you're honest and truthful and you just work hard, people will help you. There's always a path. Again, I've worked recently with some amazing people, and some of them are qualified like you wouldn't believe. Other people's are not, but you always treat everybody the same. Even now, I'm not a licensed aircraft engineer. However, people kind of trust me because they know that if I have a problem and I don't understand it, I would ask. And that's the big thing with aviation. You can never, because it's so safety conscious, you can never try and pull the wool over anyone's eyes.
Yeah.
Because it's always about safety, safety, safety. Yeah, it's a difficult industry to get into, but it's rewarding when you're in there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. Let's come back to Stuart Aviation Furniture then. How did it all start?
So I ended up, after I was working for Monarch at Luton, and I was doing some work for Jet2 as well at the time, bouncing back between the two. And then Monarch, unfortunately, went bust again, another closure. And I ended up back at RAF Lehman, stripping Tornadoes down for parts. And at the time, they were taking the Tornadoes apart to put the parts in to keep the bombers flying for Afghanistan. And there were so many pieces and parts that were getting thrown away. Even though there was nothing wrong with them, they just weren't required. And it kind of gave me an idea. And at the time, I had a set of airplane seats and I was building my own little camper van for when I was traveling around doing the aviation work. And I bought these seats to go in the camper van, but I didn't measure them, which I probably should have done.
Anyway,
So I had these seats and I thought, right, well, I don't really want to get rid of them, so I'll make it into an office chair for the house. And it was too big. So I put it on eBay. And at the time, this was going back 2012. So we're going back 13 years now. And the internet was kind of still evolving. So I put it on eBay thinking, oh, I might get 30, 40 quid for it. I'm not wasting my time. And it sold within an hour. And then somebody else messaged me and said, oh, I've just seen a chair you listed. Have you got any more? And that was it. So I ended up making another chair. And then this evolved. And at the time, I was doing this out of the garage, which wasn't even connected to the house. It was sort of 40, 50 feet away, with an extension lead going out the front window of the house across a road. So people were driving over this electric. It was quite shady. I've got an old Mini still. I was pushing it out the garage on a night, so I was working all day, pushing it outside, and then I had a little light on, and I was working away building bits of furniture and just items I had. And at the end of the night, I'd push the car back in and wind the extension lead back in, and it snowballed from there, really.
Now, at that time, to my knowledge, no one else was doing that, and there certainly wasn't anyone doing anything like that in this part of the world.
No, as far as I'm aware, at the time when I started doing this, there was one other company in the States, and they are brilliant at what they do. And I don't mind naming them now. The company called MotoArt. Now, they are based in California, and they were producing some insanely good stuff. They had a TV show out over there. They had a big warehouse with loads of staff. But the prices they were charging and the items they were doing were quite expensive. And I thought, well, actually, there's a gap in the market here. Nobody is doing this over, even in Europe, as far as I was aware. So I thought, well, surely if I could do this over here, but not to that scale, I could do it to a smaller scale where people could afford it, then that's a market that I could kind of get into. So that's what I aimed at. And instead of trying to build and sell one thing that's really expensive, I kind of went on the theory that I could sell 10 things that are not expensive. Yeah. And it would then Christmas tree out from there. And it has.
And what were those first things that you made then in that garage? What was outside of seats? What did you turn your hand to first? And we'll get on to talking about the plethora of different designs that you have. But what came first?
So the very first thing I made, there was two, I still remember them now, two grey leather Lufthansa seats that were X-Jet 2 from an aircraft they bought. And I can't even remember how I got. I think I bought them off a friend. And they were the very first things I made. And then I got a rudder off a Tornado that was one from down south somewhere. And I turned that into an office desk. But that didn't work very well. So that ended up going in a bin. And then I made some desk lamps just out of undercarriage lights and things like that. And then there was a guy who got in touch. Oh, no, I got a section of aeroplane window skin and built like a desk. And that was kind of the first bigger thing I'd made. And then I got hold of a door off a 737 and that turned into a desk. But at the time I wasn't doing it for a lot of money. And like the guy who bought the desk, I delivered it to Gatwick, near Gatwick Airport, for him for free, and ended up carrying it up three flights of an aircraft door up three flights of stairs. Because at the time I just wanted to,
yeah, get your business going. You do these things, don't you?
Yeah, and not so long back, I saw the desk, one of the very first desks I'd made actually popped up on eBay. And this was only 3-4 years ago now, and it was up for sale for more than what the guy paid for it back in 2012, which was quite nice.
Now, these pieces that I see in the same way that come up, they tend to be, I suppose in old language, pieces for executive offices. That seemed to be a place, but that's changing now, isn't it? You know, you've got the whole, I'm not being sexist here, but you've got the whole man cave generation. You've got people who design their own interiors. What sort of things are you designing at the moment? I know you've done desks, some coffee tables, seen the chairs. Tell us some of the other things that you're working on.
Well, it's very, and this is the things that people don't see. So I'm giving secrets away now. I have to sit and I study what people like and what are in trend, colours and stuff like that, because I am fully aware that I don't have one market. Now, I will have corporate businesses who will just want a boardroom table or they want some chairs and things like that. But I also know there's a market for wives and husbands who have a partner or a family member who's in aviation. They just want to get something for them that's a little trinket or a show of appreciation or present, things like that. So I have to go full scale across the board.
Yeah, you have to span the whole sector.
Yeah. So quite often, if people, when I'm on my social media, I will show something like, just as a prime example, I will show like a chromed 747 wheel, which looks amazing and it's got a big price on it. But then the next day, I will quite happily show a piece of skin that's got a little simple clock in it, and I will try and sell that for 35 quid. Because I understand that if I just target one market, I would then become a one-trick pony. Whereas there's a lot of people, and not everybody can afford high-end stuff. So I have to, go straight across the board with lots of different original things.
Right. Now you're competing now with lots of new entrants into your space. Don't know if I call it a market, a sector, into your space. And I wouldn't expect you to give me any of your trade secrets, but where the heck do you get all this stuff from? I know back in the day, I used to walk across into an airfield. I could have literally walked up to an aeroplane, taken a bit off it and walk home. But those days are well and truly over. Where'd you get this stuff from?
Well, this is where my history of being in aviation comes from, because I know lots of people now, and I've been with aircraft now since 1998, which, looking back on it, that's a long time ago. So I've got people in the industry who I know and who know me and what I do. So a lot of things actually come to me now. But also I know and have a lot of rapport with the Breakers Yards and the Breakers Yards over in the States and people like that. So I know that if I need something kind of specific, I know where to go and get that. And it's difficult because, like I explained just before, I have to be able to keep things affordable and not rip people's eyes out, because I hate that. When I see someone selling a bit of aeroplane skin as a key ring for £45, I know what the value of that piece of scrap is, and I don't like it, because these customers and these people won't necessarily understand what that's worth. And I'm like, it annoys me. I'm like, I just want people to be happy. So I'm like, I'll then have to make something. And the amount of times over the years where people have said to me, you're selling this too cheap. You're selling it too low. And even competitors, even from over in the States, companies from in the States have got in touch and like, man, that is way too cheap. You're not even letting me compete with that.
Yeah.
How are you doing it for that? And the problem is, well, it's not a problem. It's I have to. And that's the way I see it. It's easier to sell 10 things cheaper than one thing expensive.
Yeah, okay. But let's talk about some specific things. So doing my little homework and talking just before we hit record, you're pretty handy at getting an aircraft fuselage as well, aren't you?
Yeah.
I know there's quite a well-known story of the ATR 42 that you've got, but you've got a Bizjet fuselage at the moment. Tell us about some of these little captures.
Well, I may have agreed to buy a plane today. Actually, that's breaking news. I don't even know if that's going to happen yet. But yes, I bought.
Can you tell us what it is, or is it?
I don't even know what it is. It's a monoplane that has crashed, and the guy wants to sell it, but it's got no engine in it. So I'm trying to think of what I could do with it. Really,
right? Okay.
But it's not expensive, so that's the other thing.
Okay.
But I also like to do fun things, so I'm sure we could do something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I bought the ATR 42, which was full aeroplane minus the expensive bits. Then had to move that to the workshop. I didn't tell the landlord, and there was a little bit of an argument with the landlord when an ATR 42 landed, shall we say, landed down the back. I said it was a vehicle because I'm allowed to park vehicles. And as far as I was concerned, it didn't have wings. So technically it was a vehicle, but they didn't see that. So I had to make that go away. But yeah, I've had Gulfstream fuselage. I've bought sections of BA, Airbus. I had a cockpit off a 737, which used to be my office. But then after COVID, the business was struggling a bit because people didn't have money to spend and everyone was tightening up. So I had to do what I had to do to keep the business going. So the cockpit went, and because I wasn't using it as an office, because I am a one-man band, I can't be making things and be in an office. So that went.
Stuart, what else have I got? Is it inappropriate to ask you what the value of something like that is?
Again, difficult question.
Yeah.
Now, I'm quite happy to tell. I sold my cockpit for $7,000.
Right.
Which was cheap for what it was. Because if you want to go to one of these Breakers Yards
and get
you want a cockpit section off a 747 or an Airbus or a Boeing 757, whichever, you're looking about £20,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the cockpit section off the 737 that I had actually went to Blackpool, and the guys turned it into a glamping pod now.
Right.
Seeing the TV show that I'd done.
Yeah.
So it's nice that that's gone and that's had a repurposed life as well.
Yeah.
I could have done that, but I didn't.
And what do you do with all these aircraft fuselages? Give us some ideas of how you've developed them into products.
Well, I'll use the ATR for an example. So the ATR I bought, and I wanted to see how much of it I could recycle, because nobody looks at doing this. So the cockpit section actually came off. That went down to Cornwall, and that's becoming an ATR 42 simulator for flight training. All the top skin and the window sections, they've gone away to be clocks and lighting and wall sculptures, things like that. The belly sections, some of them were damaged too much, so I harvested off them structure off the floors to use in builds later down the line, which I'm going to be doing shortly. And other ones, the decent sections, I've kept some of those sections. So I've got like belly sections of ATR-42 on my racking, which at one sometime they're going to turn into sofas, because why not? So I try and reuse and recycle as much of something as I can. Even the insulation, all the insulation out came out the aircraft, and a guy bought that, and he did his extension. He's sort of, he had a man cave he was building in Scotland, and he fitted all the insulation into that. So it's all about repurposing.
Well, I never knew that. This is the kind of response we love to get from readers every time we publish an edition of The Aviation Historian, the journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of aviation history. Topics such as a secret RAF plan for a trans-global bombing raid on mainland Argentina during the Falklands War in 1982. Or the inner workings of the Lewis machine gun. Or the use of unmanned B-17 Flying Fortress drones in post-war atomic weapons testing. Or what it was really like to be an Imperial Airways passenger in the 1930s. And now, after 50 quarterly issues over the past 12.5 years, we are going annual. The same fresh, stimulating, high-quality content, but in a different package. Plus, we're doing books and specials. The Aviation Historian. We're print. We're digital. We're flying history for connoisseurs. But we're not on sale in newsagents. Find out more at theaviationhistorian.com.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Where's this critter's creativity come from, Stuart? Do you look at that ATR-42 and think, I've got a sofa there, I've got some clocks there, I've got a desk, I've got some seats. Is that how you do it? Or do you do research? Do you get ideas from videos? How does that sort of inspiration all come to you?
No, that's exactly how I do it. Okay. I look at something, and because obviously now, because I've been doing this so long, and with me being a structural kind of guy, I know how easy or difficult it would be to do now. Whereas years ago, I would have just tried to do it and failed maybe, or tried it like with the Tornado rudder desk. It didn't quite work. It was too wobbly. But now I can go, right, well, I know how I can do that because I know how that's made. And that's a big thing for me because I'm still in the aviation industry and I know my way around a plane. I know how these things work and I know how to make them work if they aren't meant to be. So that's a big plus for what I'm doing. And that's why I keep doing the civil aviation side that I'm still doing now, because it keeps me kind of on point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Totally it does. And I suppose that then begs a question. Is an aeroplane or do you do military stuff as well, civil stuff? Do you do anything out of the aviation sector at all?
No, I have, yeah. I did mostly the TV stuff that I've done before has all been non-aviation. Apart from the helicopter glamping pod, I was asked by a couple of production companies back in the day when I did a TV show for a BBC 2 TV show called Flipping Profit. And that was nothing aviation-wise. I ended up building coffee tables out of household radiators. I was building lights out of oyster baskets, which I actually got reported to Watchdog for, but that's another story. And then, yeah, I was like the front end of a Mini, because, again, I know how a Mini's constructed. I built a sofa out the front end of a car. And then I ended up doing the stuff with George Clark's Amazing Spaces, where I ended up building a fireplace up a mountain in Wales in 24 hours. And a waterfall feature. So a lot of the stuff outside of aviation has been from the TV, but I can still do it now. Like,
Yeah.
If somebody brought me something now and says, could you do this? It'd be a big fat yes.
So Stuart, a question, I suppose this is a business question, really, because I do come across you, obviously, on LinkedIn, on my day job, an awful lot. Your business is quite scalable because it's a very, very attractive product that you offer. But you are the engine. Have you ever thought of bringing, listen, let's just get three extra Stuarts on board. We'll go buy a 747 that's being scrapped. We'll chop it up. We'll bring it, and we'll just whack this stuff out. Is that something that appeals? Is that in you? Is that what you'd like to do? Or does it just come back to that point you were making earlier that you like to do it for a reason?
That's a really good question. I think because of the business I'm doing, I think if I had other people on board, it'd be difficult to kind of gauge if people would like it as much. And I'm not being pigheaded, because anybody who knows me knows I'm not like this. Would people think that it's not made by me? So would it be as good? I don't know. It's like I say, it's a question I've not really been asked before. I'd love to get someone else involved because it's a mega, mega stressful thing, because I'm having to literally do welding, painting. Today I was doing upholstery, and I'm not an upholsterer. I do the shipping, so I'll have to build timber boxes to ship worldwide. I've had to get a friend of mine who's a joiner, and he's give me advice on how best to kind of build box shipping boxes. And then you have to look into the shipping rules. So I'm then a logistics guy, and I'm also buying parts, and I'm having to then get parts for builds that are just coming in. So I've got things ahead. And then, as well as doing all the social media, and as well as doing the my civil aviation job as well. So getting other people involved would be incredible, but it's so intense. I don't think anyone else would enjoy it as much as I do.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
okay,
I absolutely love it.
Yeah. And that really comes through. That really does come through. So I suppose the next question is there a signature Stuart piece? Is there something that you just love doing and you've got to keep doing it because it's your best product?
I'd say there's a piece that people think is my signature piece, whereas I maybe don't. And
what's that then?
Is my mirror polishing. And it doesn't matter what it is. If I seem to have got a knack of being able to polish the aluminium, and I do it differently to everybody else as well. And it's almost like the KFC secret ingredient. I don't know how I've managed to get all right at it, but I suppose that's the determination that I've always had. Anything I polish, the clocks, the desks and stuff like that, people tend to go, that is amazing. And I agree, but I think my signature pieces are the ones where I get freestyle design on them. So okay. I'll get a lot of customers who come to me and say, I want this. This is how I want it. And I'll build that to exactly how they want it. But when I get a customer come to me and they say, I want a desk, go with it. That's when my brain starts going, right then, this is how we're going to do this. And the customer will always get more than what they want, because I just want them to be happy. And I want everybody, when they see their piece, because this is at the end of the day, people will come and see these items that I'm building in their homes or businesses. They want them to show off. They want them people to go, I like that. So I need to make sure that happens. So when I get freestyle on a design, it gives me goosebumps, and I'll be working late at night to make sure a wiring is routed the right way, or I'll make something up to do. Like, for instance, today I've been making armrests for some chairs that are going out to a company in Madrid. I wouldn't want these seats to go out half done, if that makes sense. So I have upholstered these arms myself, so I knew that they were right and they fitted, and I've done it all my own way. So the customer has got more than just somebody making an armrest. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There's a lot that's gone into it. It's all handmade.
So do you have a favourite piece that you've made? What's your favourite? There must be a favourite somewhere.
I would hand on heart say the Puma helicopter glamping pod that I did for Johnny Vegas's glamping show was the favourite because of the amount of stupid stuff that went into it, but that made work. Things like designing a table from Japan and a roof terrace that came from an idea from France, and then trying to then engineer everything I know into one thing, but then also trying to make it better by adding a PlayStation, adding a fridge in the floor, adding this on the wall, sticking Lego men inside it, hidden away. That won't even broadcast. There's little Lego men inside that glamping pod everywhere, looking right. Like the drilling rivets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'd say that was the best piece I've ever done because of the scale and the sheer just man hours and blood, sweat and tears that went into that. I gave that everything, absolutely everything.
Yeah. I suppose then that leads me on to the next question. What's the most challenging piece that you've had that's really taken you right to the end?
Ooh. So there's two, and neither of them are actual planes.
Okay.
So I had a customer come to me years ago when I was in one of my previous workshops, because I think I'm in workshop number 4 now, because it's just grown and grown and grown. And he wanted a boardroom table, but he wasn't really into planes. And he saw my old Mini there and says, could you build me a boardroom table out of an old Mini? Which in the classic car scene is massively frowned upon, cutting an old car up. So I had to get a rotten car and then make it look like it wasn't rotten anymore. But the problem was I had to get this Mini up a spiral staircase. So I had to design the car so that it looked like a car, but that could come apart into about 38 pieces and be carried up this spiral staircase. But the one thing that couldn't was the sheet of glass, which we got stuck. And at one point we all let go because we couldn't move it. It was wedged on 3 sides. And we said, we're just going to have to let this go and get some more glass a bit smaller. And we let go. And then weirdly enough, it kind of clicked into place.
Yeah.
And we rescued it and got it in. And then last year, I built a Santa's Grotto, which was an aircraft cabin for a shopping center down in Bournemouth.
Yes, I did see that down my part of the world.
Right. Well, yeah, that was hard because I had to part build it in my workshop without a roof on it, and then dismantle it and move it from the northeast down to Bournemouth and put this up outside and then make it amazing and in a very, very short space of time. The problem was there was a lot of variables and the install time slipped slightly, but stress-wise and the travel, it was a 7-hour drive each way.
Yes.
So it made me almost quite ill that. But again, that's me pushing and pushing and pushing to make sure something's right. And I'll always make sure something's right before I let it go, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, I'm not the first media person that's come your way by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I shouldn't even class myself in that category. You've been on TV, you've been on the BBC, you know, you've done the things with Johnny Vegas. How do you go about promoting something like this? I mean, I know you, I've followed you for a very long time. I sort of feel like I know you because I have, but a lot of people don't. How do you go about promoting this? Because it's just so unique.
It is. I've never paid for advertising. I don't believe that I need to, because I think that what I'm doing will be enough to get out there. But again, it is very difficult because aviation isn't a massive sector, and there are other companies out there now that are all kind of chomping at the bit to kind of have a bit of the pie as well. So it is very difficult. So I always just try and be me and come across and show people that I give everything for them. But promotion-wise, the TV stuff, you don't really get a lot off the back of it. Everybody thinks TV's glamorous and you get paid and you do all this and you get loads off the back of it. I've never really got much off the back of the TV stuff. But it's recognition more than anything.
Yeah.
And it's difficult with promoting. And I went out to an exhibition, an aviation exhibition in Barcelona. And it was very, very strange because there was a lot of people that were on LinkedIn. There were company CEOs, all staff members there. And the amount of people were stopping me because they recognized me. I didn't have a clue who some of these people were. But there was also a lot of people who didn't know who I was, which then gets the fire in the belly going and going, right, well, why don't you know who I am? I want to be the person that you come to. So then it pushes me on even more.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And do most of your unique pieces and designs specifically as requests come from referrals and people who have said, oh, he's done this for me, you want to speak to him, or have you heard about Stuart? Is that how it works?
Yeah. I'd say 80% is word of mouth. Because I believe that if someone's happy, they'll tell everyone. And that goes back to the theory of it's easier to sell 10 things cheaper than one thing expensive. If you've got 10 items, 10 people have got them. It's like a tree and branches.
Yeah.
That will gain and grow and grow and grow and grow. And eventually you'll get a lot of people seeing and knowing about your items. It is difficult to get out there. Even fighting algorithms on social media, you can never quite get it.
Yeah. No, I know. I know that challenge. Have you ever thought about a lot of these are structural things, you know, lots of cowlings and structural elements of the aircraft. Do you ever consider doing things like, I don't know, landing gear or the internals from an engine or pieces like that, pieces of hydraulics and stuff that doesn't normally get?
I do. However, I've always had a theory as well that if somebody, say, for instance, somebody's buying something off me and they say, for instance, they buy it for £500. If any of their friends come round and say, that's nice, what is it? Then there's no point. Because if someone's actually asking what something is, there's no real sense to it. So I try and make things that people recognize. So you've got the seats, the windows, the cowlings, the jet engine blades, the other bits of cabin on the interior, things like that. But I always keep stuff. So I use wiring and hydraulics and stuff within other builds. So as an example now, I've got a coffee table that's going out to Madrid next week, and it's a turbine disc off an A320 engine. But just a disc on a table doesn't look very good. So what I've done is I've kind of entwined around the base of it a load of pipework and valves and stuff like that to try and give it a bit more of an industrial kind of look.
Yeah.
So, and I've just recently got some aircraft escape slides that I want to try and do something with, because everybody understands what an escape slide is, but no one's doing anything with them. So I want to try and do something. So I don't know why, but I want to build a hammock out of an escape slide. I want to see if I can do it.
Okay, right. Okay, looking. So then, you know, that goes from promoting to how you sell the products. How's this structured? Do people go to your website, or do they see you on social media? How does that work? Because everything we work on that I see is pretty unique. So once it's gone, if that makes sense. So you can't have like a static showroom.
No, you're right. My website, it's very difficult to do because I got a website that I designed it all myself. I did it all. It's not the best. But like you say, everything's always different. You can never get the same condition part all the time. So for me to say, have a website shop where I say, oh, this is for sale and there's 100 of these, I can't do it. But because I also offer that many different variations of that, it would be difficult to keep track of it. So all I do now is I just say, I tell you what, just ring me. So I usually do everything on LinkedIn and Instagram. that's the main ones I do. I did have a Facebook page, but last year it got hacked and I had to start again. And now Facebook's dropped off. So like my Facebook page, I've only got like 200 followers on that now, whereas I had 8,000 followers previously. And I can't get in touch with any of those people now. So everything's done on LinkedIn and Instagram because they're great. They're global. So for me, you've got a global advertising that's free. And if people want to, they can come to my website or they can get in touch via those sites and say, what could you do? And I can custom kind of design something from there. And then like the payment side of it as well, a lot of people are worried with that. So I offer like, I'm having to offer different payment options, which wasn't something previously I thought about. So running a business is, a lot of people don't see the behind the scenes kind of aspects to it that are the kind of like the 60-70% of what goes on. Everybody only sees the kind of final product, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I understand. And is there a project that you've always wanted to do but has either been too grand or too much time or would take you out of your normal day-to-day job for months on end? Is there something in Stuart's head that's, you know, I've got that B-52 and I'm going to make it into, or something like that?
No, I would always do anything. The only thing I won't touch is anything historic.
Okay, right.
So say I've got some historic things, I've got some very historic things in, and it gets kind of, you've got to be very careful because you've what I'm technically doing is destroying items, and I have to because I have to, I know I'm watched by the CA and I'm watched by the ICAO, and the engine manufacturers, CFM, follow me. Now, are they following me because they like what I'm doing, or are they following me because they're keeping an eye on what I'm doing? So I have to make sure everything I'm doing is destroyed to a point that it can't be used again. So if I got something
historic, I understand.
If I got something historic, I have to destroy it. So I won't do some things, and I also won't touch anything if someone's been injured in it. Because I will never ever profit from someone's, I say profit. There's not much profit, but.
No, I understand what you're saying.
I won't create from somebody else's misery. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was going to actually ask you that because I was going to, I suppose I was going along the lines of wrecks and bits and pieces because there's very popular social media groups now of cockpits, relics, and we had a chap on the show couple of years back, quite fascinating sort of sector. But as you say, sometimes you cross a very uncomfortable line.
Yeah. It's a line I won't do. There's only been one time that I've had to, and I can't really divulge too many details because I've still got the piece now, but I had to buy something that somebody was injured in at some point. But the reason I bought it is because I'm going to build a memorial out of it. So
okay, right. That's understandable. Goodness me.
Yeah. But if, say, a light aircraft comes and it's had an accident or an incident and people have been severely injured, I will walk away and I'll say no. I'm sorry, I'm not going to get involved with that because there's plenty of other pieces out there that you can for me to do things with and will come my way.
Yeah. And do people approach you on that basis sometimes then?
Yeah. You would be amazed at, I would say once a week, maybe more, I'll get offered a plane, for instance. And usually it's something that somebody's crashed or they've gone, look, we've had an accident, the insurance have written it off. Do you want to buy it? A lot of them are from abroad as well. And the shipping costs make things, even if it wasn't something that someone's been involved with, the shipping costs of bringing stock in, especially with Brexit now, and now that you've got the idea of tariffs being involved places, and it's more things I've got to look at. I've got to kind of solely concentrate on the UK. So, yeah, I've got to be careful what I use and what I don't use, and then, again, make sure what I'm doing is absolutely above board.
And is there a desire to, you talked about other pieces and other things, you know, I don't know, pieces of trains or pieces of ships or things like that. Is there a desire to do anything like that? Or is it an ad hoc? If it comes up, I'll have a look. You know, might do something, might not.
Pretty much, because you could never, ever, ever tell what's going to happen next week. That's one thing I've realised. There's little things hidden around the world that would blow people's mind. About 3 weeks ago, I was offered an ex-RNLI lifeboat, completed, literally just been taken out the water. Thinking, what am I going to do with that? Yeah. I was on Twitter and people were messaging me because there was a guy who was selling off an Intercity 125 train and it had no engine in it. And everyone's saying, this would make a great glamping pod.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, you're right, it would, but it's also 40 tons.
Yeah.
And I've got a workshop that I couldn't get a Puma helicopter out of. How am I going to get an Intercity train into me?
Yeah.
So there's logistics with stuff that make things not really great, but. No, I'd love to be able to go over to say the States and do a build there and then.
Yeah.
Kind of do like
in one of those graveyard places, one of the aircraft graveyards.
Yeah. Turn up there with a bag of tools and a bag of like a box of kit and just go, right, we'll take that off there and we're gonna do it now and do it all live. I think that'd be quite cool.
Yeah. Oh well, TV producers out there, it's got to be a show. It's got to be worth doing something like that. We've talked about, you know, some of the challenging bits. What are the highs for you over the last decade or so?
Just being still here, if that makes sense. Because I started out in a garage with an extension lead and a little fluorescent light tube, making some chairs and some lamps and the odd desk. And I've gone from there to a small workshop, to another one, to a bigger workshop. And now I'm in the place now. And we've had COVID. We've had all sorts going on with the world. I've had financial crashes. And I'm still here, 13 years down the line. And people still know who I am. So that's a sense of pride. Because it's something I've never expected. And it's something I never aimed for. It's kind of just materialized, but I'm proud of where it is. Don't get me wrong, it is phenomenally hard and overheads are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So I have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, but I won't stop until somebody tells me to.
So for those who don't know where Stuart can be found on LinkedIn and Instagram, how can we follow you?
So my LinkedIn's a bit sneaky because it's a personal account, but it's Stuart Aviation Furniture on LinkedIn. And on Instagram, it's Stu_ArtAviation. Or just search Google for Stu Plain Stuff and it'll come up.
Right. Okay. We'll put links to that in the show notes. Before I let you go, though, how do we find out? Some of your pieces are spectacular. I mean, they're spectacular. Top of the range stuff. I get that, and that might for the moment be out on my range. You mentioned some smaller items. How do we find out about that stuff? Because I don't see that come up because they go too quickly. How do we find out when, I suppose, for the av geeks out there who wants something a bit more affordable, how do we find out about that? How do we track you?
Either keep an eye on my Instagram pages, or if you want something, send me a message and I will make it how you want it and to a budget.
Well, there you go. If that's not an offer to take up, I don't know what is. Stuart, fascinating conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Peter.
Right, that's it. We'd like to thank Mikoki at the Aviation Historium for his support. And we'd also like to thank White Hearts for our music, of course. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and you can find Ellie, Tim and Gareth on the extended social feeds. That is Instagram, Facebook, Threads, Blue Sky, LinkedIn, and of course, Twitter X. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Stuart.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Thank you.
legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.